Cunningham for another extraordinary message on Gill Athletics Connections.
All right, welcome back here to the Gill Athletics Connections podcast. Really excited you guys have joined us here. We continue here in season five, just adding multiple guests that are just adding so much value. I hope you are receiving value because that is really the name of the game here. I'm so humbled to be your host, Mike Cunningham, National Business Development Manager for Gill Athletics. And today we're gonna have a lot of fun. I like learning new things. And so I'm willing to bet I'm going to learn some new things today, and you are as well. Help me welcome the coach of Raleigh Walkers, the wise, the wonderful Mr. Michael Roth. Michael, how are you, sir?
Great, Mike. How are you doing on today?
I'm awesome. I'm probably going to bounce between Michael and Mike a lot. I just realized when I called you Michael, and I was like, oh, I was calling you Mike earlier. Bunch of mics. Either one works. Just got a bunch of mics here. Absolutely. Thanks for being here today, man. I'm really excited about this, actually. Not only your own journey, which I know a little bit about, but also to just have a kind of a greater discussion of the race walk in general about, you know, where should it fit? Where does it fit? Why should it fit maybe in a larger scale? So I'm excited to have that conversation with you as well, because, man, Michael, there are advocates, there are fans, and then there is whatever level you are on. How I feel about coaches, I feel is how you feel about race walking. Like, I'm trying to match your energy for race walking towards coaches, man. So I really love passion, and that exudes from you in regards to the race walk specifically.
Yeah, sometimes it'd be an unhealthy obsession, I think would be a better way to term it.
I'm glad you said that, because we're going to have that discussion as well, I think. All right, perfect. Well, Michael, before we get there, you have an extensive coaching background as well, and that's what I wanted to dive into first. So why don't we kind of get in our Wayback Machine here. Somewhere coaching became like an idea of like, oh, it could actually be a career for me, not just maybe something that was done to you, assuming you were an athlete. Where does track coaching, where does it start for you?
It really goes all the way back to high school. I was moderately successful. You know, I was sort of like the Swiss Army knife on the team. I could pretty much jump into any event. And between my junior and senior years of high school, my best friend, to sort of segue over to the side a little bit, my best friend at the time was a junior national champion in the race walk. And I just loved the sport so much and wanted to learn how to do it so that I could coach it. That was always sort of the mentality. I was like, I figured at some point I'd be coaching this sport. And his father taught me how over the summer, and then I didn't really do anything with it in my senior year. But when I got to college, it was in our college conference. Okay. And the coach, you may have heard of he's a Hall of Fame coach, Steve Borbé.
Oh, yeah.
He's at Bayshore High School. Well, I believe he just retired, but he was my college coach. And it was in our conference. And he was like, anybody who knows how to do this or is willing to do this gets a varsity letter. And so my hand went up, knowing where I was already on the team. I was like, this might be my shot. Right. And so I originally started out being a 400, 800 guy, and just rolled over into that and started doing it as an athlete, but always with that mindset of coaching it. And through college, I did a lot of coaching of myself. You know, the workouts I kind of got from the coach as, you know, distances and times and stuff like that, and then did my own research. But the technical end of it, I was self-coached.
So let's go back to high school. So one, you were introduced to the race walk in high school. That's interesting. Where did you grow up? Because it almost seems like it's pockets of race walking, not universal here in the U.S.
I was in Suffolk County in New York, which is part of the eastern half of Long Island. Mm-hmm. And at the time I was doing it, the boys coaches in New York had already removed the event from the state meet, and it had been there for about 10 years or so. But on Long Island, it was still strong. And the sort of the guru of race walking in that area is a guy named Gary Westerfield. And I became connected to him over the years, and he was coaching me for a while. But he, pretty much anybody who's been on Long Island over the last 20 or 30 years has been coached directly or indirectly by him or one or two other people.
And you mentioned this was really interesting to me when you were introduced specifically to the race walking, but track in general. You said, I kind of always had an eye that I was going to coach. I'm probably paraphrasing that here a little bit. Mm-hmm. What was it about in high school that you kind of seem like you are like, I'm going to be a coach, so let's figure out all these events. What was it? Why in high school? That's pretty early.
I don't know. that would be a great question. Like, you know, if I had a DeLorean or some other time machine, right. Go back and try to ask myself that question. But it was that was the mindset. It was like, I'm going to coach on some level. And I mean, maybe it was because I wasn't a high achiever as an athlete and recognized that I never was going to be.
Interesting. What kind of relationship did you have with your high school coaches?
It was always great. I mean, they challenged me. I remember the first time I ran the 400, and the assistant coach, who was our sprint coach, came up to me and he goes, if you're going to run the 400 like that, you're never going to be good.
Oh.
And it was like I've been punched in the face.
Yeah.
And I was like, he's trying to tell me something here.
Right, right.
And so I asked, I was like, what do you mean? And he goes, that was the question I was looking for you. It was, okay, what do you mean by that? And then he broke down the 400 meters for me right there, like the first week of practice.
Okay.
And again, limited on athletic talent, but I understood that event at the highest level after that, because he was a really good coach.
What you know, I'm kind of like playing this movie in the head that you're telling it. Did you do the stereotypical, you know, go out as fast as you can and come home dying, or did you do the reverse? Like, I'm going to jog the first 200 and then I'll bring it in. Do you remember?
I don't remember what I did. I just remember the feedback was jarring.
Yeah, harsh. It's never going to work out this way.
Yeah, but he broke the event down to me, and it's the model that the pro athletes use today when they're running the 400, you know, all the different phases of the race. And I mean, in my older, slower self, I, you know, when I get out there and do stupid things, and go run in like an all comers meet, it's, you know, I still follow that pattern, and it hurts just as much as it always did.
Yeah, just a little bit better outcome at the end.
Yeah.
Right. So where did you go to school and what did you study thinking in your head, I'm going to be a coach?
They had nothing to do with it. I went to Stony Brook University on the North Shore of Long Island. They're a pretty good, pretty successful D1 program now. Back when I was there, there were D3. And I went to school for history.
Okay.
Yeah, so that really wasn't, you know, didn't help me in the job market.
But with the thought of like, I'm going to go teach history so I can coach?
At some level, yeah. There was a thought that I was going to teach high school, and that didn't work out. I know I've been in and out of schools a little bit here and there, but didn't really ever get a, you know, full-time teaching position.
Yeah, okay. So how did it go in college, though? Because you continued on, you raised your hand as soon as it was at varsity letter time, which I would have done the same. My introduction to track is kind of similar. They said, you know, hey, we have indoor track if you'd like to do it. And I was like, oh, you probably didn't have this attitude. I was like, how hard can indoor track be? And I'll get a varsity letter. Sweet. I learned subsequently that it was extremely hard and I was not very good, but yeah, I was that hand raiser as well. It's like, all right, yeah, cool. I'll do that. How did college go learning the event and continue it on?
It was a struggle the first two seasons because the technical nature of the event, and I wasn't training for the race walk full time. I was doing a little of this and a little of that and still doing 400, 800 and running cross country. And so, you know, kind of at that age, you really need to be focused on an event area so that you can maximize the motor learning and all that other stuff if you want to dive into the sports science. And I wasn't doing that. I was just trying to get by on. I knew the technique and I was in good shape. But the end of my sophomore year, I went to Coach Morbay and I was like, I'm a race walker from now on. I'm not doing cross country. I'll train during the fall, but I need to get better at this because this is what's going to help the team the most. And that junior year, I was undefeated in all the race walk events that I was in that were conference based. I mean, I didn't win Penn relays. I got crushed there, but that's all, you know, that's like a pro meet. So, and then my senior year, the only person that I lost to was my teammate who had transferred in from another school, the same guy whose dad taught me at a race walk. We ended up going to school together for my senior year, his junior year.
What do you think? You know, it's so interesting. We've heard this type of story before where someone just falls in love with an event, whether they were good or not good. That seems to be kind of irrelevant. You know, whether it's the court. So you could have been a quarter miler. Like that could have been, no matter how good or not good you are, you could have been like, man, I just love the challenge of the quarter. It's one lap that, you know, there's something about that. Mm-hmm. What was it? You went in going into your junior year and told coach, hey, I'm out because I am in on this event. Mm-hmm. What was it about that event that just drew you 100%?
Part of it was the ability to contribute to the team. Mm-hmm. So as a 400 meter runner or cross country runner, like the joke on cross country, that is, I was Captain C because I was the 15th or 16th fastest guy on the cross country team. So I was the captain of the C team.
Sure.
And then on the 4x4, it went run and track, as I was always the first guy not picked for the relay. So, you know, it was just, you know, I'd be in the third or fourth heat in an open event. So, you know, I wasn't scoring points for the team, and mm-hmm. that was important to me to feel like I was contributing.
Yeah.
And this was an area where I could make a difference, and we won conference meets because of my points. Yeah. So, and the coach was like, you know, I see where you're going with this. You want to make sure instead of scoring 2 or 3 points, you want to score 10. And that was it.
Seems like a pretty good plan.
That and the technical challenge. I've always been, you know, somebody who likes to dive into something and figure it out. And it was so difficult. And even today, I still, you know, go over the very basics when I'm doing my own training and reminding myself of all these basic techniques that I need to remind myself of because it didn't come naturally to me. So there's the challenge.
And what's the status of race walking where you're at a Division III school? Is it at Nationals at D3 at this time? You mentioned it, it's a conference. What's kind of the, like, where's your role of what race walking is at this point?
At that time in the late 80s, early 90s, there were a good number of schools in New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, that whole mid-Atlantic region, and then mm-hmm. even up into New England that were D3 schools that had race walking. And there were two conferences in that area. One of them was the PAC, Public Athletic Conference, and then the CTC, the Collegiate Track Conference. And because of the schools involved and their race walking backgrounds, they had it in their conference championships. And so it was indoors and outdoors. We had, you know, two big meets every year. And then there was in a lot of the invitationals and dual meets, and it was treated just like every other event in the sport. And we were pushing to get it into the ECAC meet and then hopefully trying to push to Nationals, and it just never happened.
Yeah. So your big meet would have been the conference meet. That was where you're going to help contribute to the team, and that was your event. And yeah, and it was the culture was big enough there that it was a full heat. Like there was plenty of guys and gals doing it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. And one of the big coaches in the area at the time was when Russ Ebbets was still coaching up at Union College. Yeah. He had some just killer athletes up there. Is they used to right? destroy me.
Yeah. I remember Russ. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. So you go through college, halfway through, you decide, hey, I am a race walker. This is how I'm going to contribute to the team. I love that team attitude from you there. What you graduate? Did you graduate with a history degree? Is that what you end up getting?
Yeah.
Yeah, I love it. What was the first, you said you wanted to coach, got this great history degree. What was the first job out of college?
I rolled into grad school
with
the idea of trying to get a teaching degree. In New York, you need a master's degree to teach.
Is that right?
Yeah, you're not going to get a teaching job unless you have a master's degree. Mm-hmm. In most of the area, you know, if you go real rural, you might be able to get jobs. But so I went into a master's degree to get the teaching certification. And then at the same time, we had a change in coaching at Stony Brook, and there was an opportunity for a grad assistant job. And so I jumped in and was coaching some of the athletes I trained with previously, but then was also learning the coaching ropes and, you know, pretty much being, again, that kind of that Swiss Army knife type of guy in the office and dealing with recruiting and working mm-hmm. with some endurance athletes, but then also working with jumpers and throwers.
My favorite question, I love that you went into grad school at your undergrad, because my favorite question is always to ask, how did you handle the transition on, I always put it this way, on Friday, you were hanging out with your boys, that was your team, you know, playing, well, you didn't play Xbox back then, but you know, you were having a good time with your friends.
Super Nintendo.
Yeah. Oh, Super Nintendo. See, I'm an NES guy, but yeah, all right. And then on Monday, it's now grad assistant, but you're Coach Roth. How did you handle that transition, you know, going from, you know, we're peers to, you know, I may not be a full-time coach, but I got additional responsibilities over you guys. How did you handle that?
It really wasn't an issue, because I think parcel because the head coaching situation had changed. And so there were different expectations and the like. I don't recall it ever really being an issue, because many of the people that I had been teammates with had either graduated, or, you know, the younger team members who were there were in different event areas. So we didn't have as much of that buddy-buddy mentality. But, right, you know, I don't recall it ever being a concern in either direction. You know, it's just, this is my job now. My role has changed, and we just, that's the way it is.
That's good. Love that. I think, you know, the grad school for coaches, I think that's awesome. Cause I think when you're that young, you know, when you're 20, 21, 22, 23, you should taste a lot of things to figure out what your actual life is going to be about. It's still crazy to me that we make 18-year-olds pick a major that's going to be their career path their whole life. It's like, man, you're 18. You don't know anything. Yeah. You know? But I think, like, this is gonna be a harsh statement. I think more people who go to grad assistant coaching should get out of coaching than not. And here's what I mean by that is, it's there to try it out and see if you really like it. And if not, great, you're getting a great degree. You've got a great undergrad degree. Maybe you go on and start a business or, you know, whatever. How did you enjoy the coaching? And you'd been doing some kind of coaching and things like that, even as undergrad and in high school and stuff. How did the now kind of more full-time coaching go for you? And did it hook you? Was it like, oh yeah, this is, I'm supposed to be a coach?
It was the most enjoyable part of the day, other than the times when I really enjoyed the academic end, the research end of academia.
Oh, interesting.
Taking my the master's degree. I'd be in the library till midnight. I loved doing research. But the being in the office and working with the kids, and, you know, I was still a kid then too, but and then I really got involved with the recruiting, and this was just around the time where high tech came out. And so I was a computer guy. So getting involved right at the beginning when they had their old DOS version and trying to figure out how to time meets with that thing. And it was not easy. It was a mess. The early versions were difficult.
Yeah.
But so getting into meat management, and then that rolled me into officiating, and all, you know, it just sort of piled everything right on top of each other.
So where did you go after grad school? Did you start teaching, coaching?
I was doing some club coaching after grad school, a little bit of high school, and then it's mostly been, you know, either high school or club, and now pretty much exclusively club. With, I mean, there are some high school athletes that I work with, but they're, you know, a lot of that ends up being remote work too, which is great with the internet that you can coach people. And other than, you know, like doing like we're doing right now, there's an athlete in Florida that I was coaching her for like 2 years before we had ever really met.
Wow.
Face to face.
But you went into full time, you coached at some institutions, right?
Mostly high school. The time at Stony Brook was about, I think it was about 5 years or so, where I was there, either part-time or full-time, you know, that grad assistant sort of thing. But going from there, it was a bunch of different high schools afterwards, both in New York and in North Carolina.
No collegiate?
No other collegiate, no.
Okay, got it. Okay.
Not for lack of trying.
We'll yeah.
Yeah. I still have the folder of emails and resumes and cover letters that I sent out, and it was well within the triple digits over the years. And
why do you think that is?
I mean, it's a community of people who know each other, and being more on the race walk end, it's difficult to break into that community, because I was doing more walk-based coaching than I was doing the NCAA traditional events of, you know, what people are used to, and sort of being isolated from the, you know, the interactions. So it was a difficult bridge to, you know, to gap or to, or to cross. And, you know, I realized that, and I also realized that this is what I really enjoyed working with. So let me just stay in my lane. And I've applied to, you know, four or five jobs over like maybe the last 15 or 20 years or so since the, when I was really looking to do it full time. And it was just things that were open that were local. So it wouldn't have involved me, you know, packing my life up and moving somewhere.
Now, we don't get into the X's and O's here, but what I'm surprised about is my assumption is that racewalk training and distance training have all more similarities than not. I know there's some technical aspects, some technique stuff, and I actually do kind of want to go over that here in a little bit because I you know, it is unique. So I'd like to, you know, maybe educate, help educate some people there. But I would think that the, you know, the cardiovascular, the endurance side of it would be similar. I don't even want to do air quotes there. It's similar.
Yeah, it's.
Could you have not crossed, you know, been a distance coach? That.
Oh yeah, and okay. Yeah, and I've worked with runners.
Yeah.
You know, on and off, but having had that, you know, when people see race walk, they don't realize that it's 99% the same thing. I mean,
sure.
You're taking somebody's body and you're making them go from A to B in a time period.
Right.
So you're gonna learn, you know, all the different thresholds that you need to work within, how you build up their endurance base, how you're working on speed and paces, and it's just math after that. And then it's the only difference on the technical end is the arms, and really the arms are moving the same way. It's just the way you're putting your feet down.
Right. Well, you know, it's amazing, Michael, when you look back at your career so far, you know, it has been, from the outside looking in, it has been very singularly focused in the race walk, which is a, you know, we're already in a small sport. We're the most participated sport, both on high school and collegiate level with track and field. But in generalization of like, you know, TV ratings, payment of coaches, payment of athletes, things like that, we're already in a niche sport as it is. And now, you know, inside of track, we talk about niche events, right? Pole vaulting or throwers, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Now we're taking it down even farther of a niche because we're talking about an event or events that aren't happening in the majority of high schools, aren't happening in the majority of colleges, aren't happening in the majority of elite meets. I think every Team USA has a race walking component to it. Correct me where I'm speaking wrong here, but you know, I think of the Olympics, world champs, those all have a race walking, components to them. And you have continued to be the megaphone for these events, like your advocacy to add them to high school and collegiate, et cetera, is unmatched. It's unparalleled that I know of. You may say, oh no, there's five other me's out there, but certainly on the, you know, where I live on the social media side, I see the passion and the megaphone of you coming out completely. How has, I love that, by the way, because I love passions. That to me is what makes people so amazing over every other group in the world. You know, giraffes don't have passion. They have passion to eat and survive. Panda, you know, humans are like, man, I find something, I lock into it. How has, when you look back at it at this point in your life, how has race walking affected, molded your life up to this point?
It's provided a lot of opportunity for me. And over the years, just tremendous experiences, realizing early that I wanted to be at a high level of the sport and that I wasn't going to do it with my arms and my legs and my lungs. They were not going to take me there. But always as an athlete, and even going back, you know, just sort of the pre-track time when I was a baseball player. And again, that it became a mental game for me because the physical talents weren't there, but I outthought my opponents, and just being able to use those skills to advance myself. I looked at it and said, well, I want to be around the pro end of the sport. How do I do that? Well, I can try the coaching aspect of it. And like you said, it's, you know, it's already a niche sport. And then I went into the quantum realm. and went to the smallest. I was Ant-Man stuck in the quantum realm. And
I'm a Marvel guy. I get that.
Yeah. and finally, the van turned back on, and I shot back out. And then there was no one here.
But, right now, some aspect of people listening are like, that was the greatest analogy I've ever heard in my life because I'm a Marvel person. Other people are like, what in the world is this guy talking about?
I'm literally just came to me right now. But that's kind of where, you know, and I've always liked to help people. So the coaching aspect becomes part of that. But then becoming an official was how I bridged that other gap and filled that need in my own life was, you know, being able to officiate at the few Olympic trials, dozens of big meets around the country, a couple international events, and then family got in the way. And I was like, that's too expensive to be traveling around the world when I need to buy diapers. So took a big step back from that. And, you know, but I can still be effective and liking to help people and, you know, feeling like, I'm making a difference in the sport in an area where it's needed. Like, how many distance coaches do you know? You know, cross country coaches, like thousands, thousands and thousands, and you know, sprint coaches and jump coaches, and even when you get to the something like the pole vault, which is pretty niche, you can rattle off people. I mean, Becca. I mean, we think of Becca right off the top. She's one of my favorite people.
Love her.
But there are hundreds and dozens of those. But then it's like, you know, again, taking the pim pills and go into my little world. You know, just being able to have an effect on the sport on a large level is kind of, you know, where my head is with it.
You know, it's clear you have a servant leader heart. I love how you said that. That works for others. Who, you mentioned a couple, what other coaches poured into you and helped guide you towards this continual serving others?
Oh, I should have put a list together.
That's okay. Well, I always put people on the spot. Don't worry.
Oh, no. I mean, I'll just rattle off names.
Yeah, please.
Matt Brand was my high school head coach. Maybe at some point, I don't even know if he's online. I haven't spoken to him in years. I'd love to reconnect with him if he's watching any of his track stuff. He was a great guy. He was a lot of fun. Art Curtis, I'm not sure if he's still with us. He was a bit older, but those were my two high school coaches. Steve Borbet was my college coach, and I talked to him probably once a month still, and it was 30 something years ago. Gary Westerfield, Jake Jacobson, who recently passed, I think it was about a year ago he passed away, but you know, still in touch with some of his family, his son and his daughter, and you just did the relationships that you build over the years. But other coaches that I've just had the opportunity to, you know, work with as peers. There's a friend of mine from South Carolina, Ian Watley. You know, I don't think a week goes by that we don't bounce something off of each other. Dave McGovern up in New York. If you've ever heard, he more than anyone, and you think I'm the Pied Piper race walking, this guy actually makes it his entire career. I don't know that he's ever had like a real 9-to-5 job. He's been a race walk coach his entire life, and he does clinics all around the world.
Wow.
And that's, I mean, he literally lives and breathes the event. But so, having these friends and colleagues and people that were mentors, and then you kind of, you know, you're on the sort of the same level with them, and you're speaking at this, you know, at the same events, and you know, it's no longer master and teacher. You're both kind of masters together, and you have your own dojo.
That's good. I love that. I love that. You know, it's, we are built on the shoulders of other men and women out there. So what's interesting to me is, you know, you mentioned a lot of great people that have poured into you, and it's sometimes hard for us to imagine it, but there are people that are standing on your shoulders, Michael. There are race walkers, race walk coaches, race walk advocates, track advocates beyond a single event that have learned from you, have watched your passion, and have emulated that because of what you've poured into others. So I love, you know, kind of seeing that full pyramid, if you will, that never ends, by the way, of people that, you know, have come because of you, and then because of others that you have come from as well. So I appreciate hearing those people. I love it. I love it. Excuse me. Okay, let's have a conversation here. We could have our own podcast, by the way, the Mike and Mike show here, which could be dangerous.
I think there was one on WFAN in New York.
Yeah.
Was they might have owned that one already.
Yeah. Was probably the key word there. Okay.
Oh, it was Mike and the Mad Dog. That's what it was. Mike and the Mad Dog.
We might make that come true right here as well. Okay. I want to have a discussion about race walking. And I mean discussion, not argument. I'm gonna be real. What's the word here? Not humble. I'm gonna show some humility and tell you a couple of mistakes that I've made in regards to race walking. And I do not make them anymore because of you know, we learn from our, well, hopefully we learn from our mistakes. And I luckily have learned from this. But I do want to, you know, explore a little bit about the race walking, where it sits in our vernacular today, where you think it should be, in your own role in that as well, as it relates to what you do for your passion and your outreach and outspeak for the event. So let me tell you a few mistakes. So I used to come from the attitude of that race walking was the dumbest thing in the world. I'm sorry. I know that hurts you so bad, Michael. I feel bad even saying, I don't anymore.
There are times when I agree with you.
Okay, good. That makes me feel better. I used to, feels like a long time ago, teach USATF level one coaches education courses. And I'm a sprint hurdles background, so I never taught the distance. But at one school, the distance coach, an emergency came up, and I did have to coach or teach the distance. Now, I used to work for Al Schmidt at Mississippi State, who is one of the just, uh-huh, you know, brilliant, you know, scientific guy. You know, I remember the first track meet we go to when I was working for Al at Mississippi State, and he's reading a physiology book, and I, like a textbook. And I was like, what a nerd. I was like, I never love it though. I love that. Love, love that. So I was trying, uh-huh, to invoke a lot of, you know, his as I'm teaching distance. And part of the curriculum, at least back then, there was, for good or bad, there was one slide, only one slide for the race walking. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, I'm so young and dumb, and now I'm just old and dumb. I made the statement when the slide came up of, I can't remember exactly what I said, but I did not say something nice. I said something like, you know, this event shouldn't even be here. So we've got one slide. It's going to be in your test. So let's talk about the three things or whatever, three bullet points that they had on there. Well, at the end of every level one, if you've taken this, you know this, you get to evaluate. Yes.
Well, you got slammed. Didn't
lo
you?
And behold, there was a race walker in the audience, and like an accomplished one. She I can't remember what she had won something. Like she was an accomplished race walker, and oh yeah, oh my, it was just like, you know, you jerk, how dare you? And I was like, oh, and that was part of my, like, I think it was the final straw for me of like, oh. However I feel about the event, I really do care about people, and I hurt a person. That was really what kind of hurt me. Mm-hmm. Like, oh man, you know, how would I feel if someone said, hey, Mike, track is the dumbest thing in the world and you've dedicated your whole life to it? Like, what a way. And I'd be like, oh my God, like, you're a terrible, yeah, person. Track is amazing because of the people. So that really hurt me. Now go back a decade. So I stopped. That was the last straw. If she's listening, thank you for being honest and standing up for yourself and your sport, because that really did.
Sometimes we need an adjustment.
100%. 100%.
And there are times where, you know, you get hit with reality, and sometimes it's painful. But then, you know, you take a step, absolutely, back and you think about what you were said. What somebody said to you, and you're like, I needed that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I almost kind of wish she would have said it to my face. You know, I had to read it, but you know, I would kind of wish you'd been like, hey, I'm just letting you know, man, that was rude, and you know, you hurt me and my, I would, you know, because then I'd be able to say, oh gosh, I'd be able to see the person and apologize. I, you know, I couldn't apologize anyway. Go back maybe a decade before, I'm coaching, you know, I coached for 10 years, and I was the, for several years, I was the national junior high hurdles coach for USATF. So I got to take the five best 19 and under high hurdlers to camp in Chula Vista. And one morning we get up early to go out to the track and the race walkers are out there, you know, the Chula Vista. I don't know.
The Chula Vista program.
Yeah.
I'm friends with all those guys.
I would assume. Yeah. Yeah. You know, I'm actually thinking, I was like, man, Michael, you might've been there, but they're out there practicing. And, you know, I've got a bunch of, you know, sprinters or guys, and even I don't think I'd ever even seen the race walk up to this point. You know, the guys are doing their race walk workout, and, you know, the kids are all just like, coach, what is going on? And I was like, I got no idea. Why don't they just run? You know, the typical stuff you probably heard, you know, why don't they just run or whatever, yada, 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 whatever. But now, while I'm, and I told you we're going to have this conversation, I'm a skeptic, meaning I'm not a fan of where race walking sits in the sport. Maybe you'll change my mind today. But now I have respect for it. It's like, oh, these men and women who are doing it and who are coaching it are talented. It is an event. Like, it's not, you know, it's not the who can whisper the loudest or whatever I've heard people say, you know, those kind of dumb jokes. It's like, wow, that it does take talent. It's amazing. So I have a lot of respect for people who do those things and do it at a high level. It's amazing. So all that to say, I'm not going to argue with you. Let's start with, where does race walking sit in America today? What I mean by that is, tell us where, is it at any of the NCAA championships, JUCO, et cetera? Is it state meet anywhere? You mentioned it used to be in New York. So kind of give us a background of like, yeah, it used to be in this many states, whatever you know or don't know. You are a history major, so I'm going to kind of look to you to be the
historian.
Kind of give us a 30,000 foot level of race walking in America today, please.
So as far as the history major thing and all that research, that's all on a website that I've run, and I've run it for, started it out in, I think it was in 2000.
What's it called?
High School Race Walk. It's hsrw.net.
hsrw.net. Okay, so there's a lot of
high school race walk.
Right there. Perfect.
Yeah, it's got as much history on the event and statistical stuff that one guy can do in all of his spare time. and then when I talked to the unhealthy obsession, it started because I was working with a group of athletes in New York as part of a club named Walk USA back in the late 90s, early 2000s. And we had some really good athletes, but this was just when Diestat started. And I got to know John Dye, and he was posting some of my results online and performance lists, and he didn't have the time for it. And I was like, I get it. You're revolutionizing the sport, and this is not in your wheelhouse. I'll just do it. And he goes, and you do it, I'll post it.
Oh, wow.
So it started out that way. And then he got too busy, so I ran it on my own site, and it's been going since then. And because Diestat actually had a gap in when it was actually a viable website, when ESPN owned it and then mothballed it, my site's the longest running track and field website in the country.
Oh, that's a cool stat, because, Diestat,
it's before
John
Miles
Dye.
Split.
Yeah. Wow, that's cool.
So I have all this data, and to answer your question, Maine has it outdoors for boys and girls, and they do a 1600. New York used to have it indoors and outdoors for boys and girls at 1500 for the girls and 1600 for the boys. And then in 1984, the boys' coaches decided that they couldn't be bothered with it, so they took the event out. And the girls still have it indoors, but not outdoors, which makes no sense. You get them going and then you shut them down.
Right.
and it hurts their ability to be recruited.
Sure.
And there are a few other states that have a little bit of it here and a little bit of it there. Virginia has some stuff. Maryland has some stuff. There was a very vibrant community down in the McAllen and far areas of Texas for about 15 years or so. The leader of that group, a coach named AC Jaime, who was just producing dozens of athletes every year, like fielding the entire under 20 team from his club. He passed away a few years ago. Actually, it was during COVID. He ended up passing away then, but he had already retired from coaching. But he had built a community down in South Texas and was, I mean, talk about changing lives. It's the poorest area of the country, and he was putting these kids into college.
Oh, wow. Love that.
So again, guys who are changing lives, and talk about mentors. They're just one of the greatest humans I've ever known. up in the Chicago area, there's some stuff that goes on, and the, Ohio had a really vibrant community for a while, but it comes and goes to based upon leadership. When coaches retire, if there's no one to take the reins, things fall apart. But the NAIA has had it in their championships. I think it they started it, it was either the late 70s or early 80s. I don't recall the when it began, but they've had it at varying distances over the years, and right now it's 3,000 indoors and 5,000 outdoors. And they're, I don't know if you know who Evan Dunphy is, a
I know the
world
name.
championship and Olympic medalist. He came through the NAIA, was an NAIA champion, and now, he's probably one of the top 10 walkers of all time at this point. If he's listening to this, his head's going to be like, oh no. No, but no, he's
And
actually one of the most humble guys ever.
he's American because
He's Canadian.
My very limited race walk knowledge is that we don't do very well internationally. More Cuban and Mexican, if I remember correctly.
Not Cuban. No, I
No.
can't ever recall a Cuban
Okay. Maybe
walker.
I was
No.
wrong there. But Mexico,
Mexico and South
Argentina,
America.
South America. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Brazil, Ecuador, Colombia,
Yeah. Ecuador.
Mexico, though, and then Canada's had some success.
Okay.
In spite of them only having usually, 5 to 10 athletes a year, they got really, really good. They
Wow.
all moved in together basically, and they trained as a group, and that's it's not a mystery or magic. If you do that and you
Right.
have some skill and you
Right.
put in the work, you get results.
So
So
no
there's the
NCAA.
NAIA, but
Yeah.
no NCAA.
No junior college,
Nope.
no NCAA. So how you kind of when you mentioned there about Evan going through NAIA, you brought up his name specifically, that I kind of get the idea that not a lot of our Team USA athletes, men and women, are going through the collegiate system then. So how are they being birthed, so to speak?
We try by hook or crook to get anyone to do this. A lot of the Team USA athletes come through the NAIA. Occasionally, you get situations. You may be familiar with the name Tim Seaman. He was on the track at
Oh,
Chula Vista
of course.
when you were out there going, "What are these people doing?" He's a coach at Cuyamaca, I think is how you pronounce it, and
Like he's legendary. Like I know that as soon as you said the name, it's like, oh yeah, I remember that guy's name. He was on every team.
So he's the cross country and distance coach out there with I think Tom Hunt is out there as well, and why am I drawing a blank? Tony Campbell is one of the coaches at that school too, the hurdler.
Oh, I was about to say, see, I was thinking, I was like, oh, must be another race walker. But I know
No,
him as the
the
hurdler.
hurdler.
Oh, wow, that's a
No, the
heck of a
hurdler.
staff. Wow.
And they're all out at there in what I believe he's in administration, but they're all out at the school, and it's a it's a junior college, and he's taken athletes that came to his cross country team and said, "You know, you're not a great cross country runner. You know who? Names are horrible with my sometimes. Nick Christie. That's who I'm thinking of. Nick Christie was a decathlete in high school." And went to this college and went there for 2 years. And Tim Seaman converted him to a race walker, got him a scholarship at to Missouri Baptist. He went there and he won the NAIA championship, broke the national record there. And now he's an Olympian, but he was a a decent high school and junior college decathlete.
Right. He wasn't
And
going to the Olympics in decathlon, though.
no, not unless
Right.
he bought a ticket.
That's awesome. So they're coming through. I think you said hook by crook. They're just coming through however you can find them. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about not technique. Let's get a little bit more in the weeds here, though, a little bit. Okay, I want to ask, how do you identify a good race walker? But before I do that, let's talk about for someone who has no idea or only thinks they have an idea of what race walking is, let's first talk about technique. We know it's a distance event. And my follow-up question to after technique is going to be, why does it have to be not only a distance event, but talk to us about, you know, the Olympics are like, I don't know, a billion miles or something like that. Why in the world does it have to be, you know, these ultra marathons, which I'm sure there's going to be some, you know, mud guys here, you know, mountain ultra distance guys, not a fan of that at all. That's just crazy stuff.
We'll call up Camille Heron and
oh my gosh,
she's the nicest in the world.
So much trouble for my ultra marathoners and stuff. It's just crazy stuff. So talk to us about the technique. What makes race walking a 5,000 different than running a 5,000?
So basically there's a technical requirement. The athlete and this is kind of where people misunderstand how it works, but there are judges out there who observe the technique, the similar to how umpires will observe hurdling technique. So you have to hurdle correctly or you have to walk correctly. And in the hurdles, if you hook that trail leg, well, they're going to throw up a flag and your day's
right.
over.
Right.
The judges out there who are observing race walking want to make sure that you're doing two things. You're as to their observation, using their eyes and not cameras or anything else, you've got to have one foot on the ground at all times. There is a flight phase. No argument there. It happens. If you take high-speed video or you take still shots, you're going to catch it. But the human brain and the human eyes can only process movement to a certain degree. And so when it's outside of your ability to process it, effectively, it doesn't happen. We know what's happening, but you know we're going to live in that world.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The other thing is that what differentiates walking from running is you're not using your quadricep to propel you upwards. When you lock your knee, when you make contact with the ground, forces change, and we can get into a whole thing of physics and motor skills and all the other science and that, but that would be hours.
Yeah,
we don't have that kind of time. But basically, because they're locking their knee, they're not propelling themselves with their quad. And reaction forces and kinetic and potential energy are being moved differently. And so that's where you get a little bit of that hip movement that people make fun of.
Yeah. Okay.
If the walkers are doing it right, they don't have that hip movement. It's the walkers who are doing it poorly.
Oh, that's
that
interesting.
Sashay, and they look like they're on the runway.
Yeah.
And that's all that. They have weak hip muscles. So they're compensating it. And their brain basically said, I have a puzzle I need to solve. And this is the only way I can do it because I'm not strong enough.
Interesting. Okay, so the two, I'm going to say main rules, because
it's two rules. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Two rules. One, I'm going to go backwards on that first contact. So they're front side mechanics, if you will, if we're thinking about a sprinter or a runner. Mm-hmm. When that makes contact on the ground, that knee has to be locked.
Yeah. Just like when you come over the hurdle.
So if you, let's say someone doesn't do that, what is the infraction?
So the first time that they're observed, or if the official is looking at it and goes, maybe it's on, maybe it's off, you know, where they're trying to give them that kind of gray area, that's when they show them a yellow paddle.
Mm.
And that's the one that looks like the less than or greater than sign.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So if you see a yellow paddle with that little symbol,
yeah, I know exactly.
Don't so have one behind me. I'm shocked. I have a paddle.
I'm really
here.
Surprised you don't have those just hanging out.
They're in my bag that I went to South Carolina with yesterday.
So it's that you know, greater than less than. Is that supposed to be the knee bend? Is that why it's that?
That's
simple?
A knee bend. Yeah, it was the easiest way to
see. We're learning. I love it. Okay, all right. Now the first rule, the way you explained it, actually makes it clears up a lot of my. Thoughts and feelings, but you know, I've seen the pictures. You know, when people want to bash on race walkers, they show the single frame of where there's a flight phase and say, see, these guys, you know, they're supposed to have one foot on the ground at all times, but look, it's happening all the time. What a farce, yada yada yada. But I think the way you put that actually makes a lot of sense. Of the rule is not for every picture, you know, I go back and do video replay. It's the judge. And by the way, if you have a problem with that, that is pretty much our entire sport of track and field, by the way. We are still human judged here. The landing of the shot, you got to pick where you're putting it, et cetera.
Yeah.
False starting, which I know there's an electronic component to it, but they're still a human. So if you have a problem with that, you have a problem with our whole sport. So I like that it's the, you know, to the best judgment of the judge. is their contact all the way through. So what happens when a judge, so you said the yellow paddle with that little, you know, horizontal V, if you will, for the knee break.
Little symbol like this.
Yep. Yeah, there you go. Yeah. What's the infraction for if someone says, hey, yeah, I see you flight time here?
So one thing also to know before answering that question is that when you see a yellow paddle shown to an athlete, that's the judge alerting the athlete that they may be in danger of breaking a rule.
Okay. So it's not an actual infraction at that point.
It's not a foul at that point.
Hey man, just be careful.
Be careful. Yeah. Got it. So like in the throws, when you see the yellow flag go up when there's 15 seconds left, it's the same. It's a warning or a caution that you need to get your stuff together.
Got it.
The other, that squiggly line one, that would be the tilde sign on the keyboard.
Mm-hmm.
That is when the judge sees both feet off the ground.
Is it still yellow?
It's still a yellow paddle. Okay, yeah,
so still,
the judges will have two paddles.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so they show those paddles to the athletes when, in their observation, they believe that the athlete is in danger of breaking one of the rules, and it's our way of saying, hey, you know, get yourself checked out.
Mm-hmm.
Go through whatever it is that your coach has taught you mm-hmm. to make these corrections. Mm-hmm. And then if they see it again, that's where you get what they would call a red card, and those get turned in. And it's the same kind of red card that you'd see in a soccer match,
mm-hmm.
essentially. We don't show it to the athlete because then they would know it's from you. So this kind of on the sly, we have to fill out this little piece of paper and send it over to another official who's sort of like a clerk. We call them a recorder. And then they post the violations on a board so the athletes know when they have fouls. And if they get three fouls in most races, and you know, for the discussion, we don't have to go over the four fouls in the penalty lane that international races use. But basically, if they get three fouls, and it needs to come from individual judges, say you were walking and I write you up a red card for a bent knee, and it gets turned in, you're not disqualified. You have one foul. Like if you foul on the long jump, mm-hmm. you still got two more attempts.
Mm-hmm.
The other judges out there on the course then need to make a determination independently of mine that you also have committed fouls when they see you. Mm-hmm. And then if three of those come in, then the chief judge shows them a big red paddle and their day is over.
Okay, a couple questions. So does that mean there's a minimum of three judges per race?
If there's not three judges, it's not a legal race.
Is there a maximum?
On the track, it's five, and on the road, it's nine.
And if and when they get three fouls, again, you are, I don't care no one listens to this podcast. I am learning a crap ton about race walking. Thank you for this, man. Okay. When and if they get three red cards from three independent judges, I get that component. I love that comparison to the long jump fouls as well, by the way, meaning they're now they're DQ'd, right? They've got three. Do they get DQ'd? Let's say they're in the middle of 5,000. This all happens in the first 2,000 meters. Do they get told at 2,000 meters, hey, you've had three, mm-hmm. just stop. Okay, good. So they don't have to complete the race and then find out.
Yeah, and they're removed on purpose, because if they have those three fouls, and then if they weren't pulled out of the race, they could affect someone else's race by mm-hmm. deciding that they're going to change paces, mm-hmm. run alongside them. I mean, at that point, they're like, I'm already out. Who cares?
Mm-hmm.
So we remove them from the race so that they can't contaminate the athletic opportunity of the other athletes.
Got it. And backtrack here real quick. I was just thinking about participation. No NCAAs, but yes, in NAIA, no JUCO, some high school, and definitely some club. AAU and USATF juniors and stuff like that?
Well, the AAU only, I mean, they don't really have like a juniors program, but they have their indoor and outdoor championship.
Yeah,
the age group stuff. And there's two summers ago, the AAU Nationals were in Greensboro at A&T.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they had 350 walkers.
Wow.
20 races, and I had to chief judge all of them.
Oh, jeez.
But I mean, no complaints. I mean, it was hot, and I was sweaty but it was wonderful. It was just one race after another for 2 days.
So AAU's got race
and,
walking.
and USATF does in the Junior Olympics
Yeah.
and the USATF under 20s and the USATF youth.
Yeah.
The youth meets are kind of sketchy. They
Okay.
don't get a lot of attendance, but the JOs are enormous.
Okay, but there's what I'm thinking is there's opportunity for kids
Yeah.
to be introduced to. Okay, all right. Okay, so let's go back to our rules. I love again, really kind of clear the fog up of, it's up to the judge's decision, which again, that's a lot of our sport, and it's three fouls, just like a long jump, triple jump, et cetera, that gets you out of the race. And you are done with the race if and when those three fouls happen.
Yeah.
Why? You mentioned in New York they used to do the 15 and 16. I think you said in NEIA they do a 3 indoors and a 5,000 outdoors. And then when we get to, and I'm not sure about you tell me about like USA Trials, but I know, maybe I shouldn't even say that. I don't know. I believe the Olympics and stuff are like the 50K type stuff. Walk us through what are those distances and why in the world do they have to be so far? And I don't mean that
I
like why. I mean, like,
don't
I just would
know.
think, like, oh, I could probably be more palpable to watch a 1600 meter race walk. I'm
Yeah.
not watching a 50K race walk, just like I'm not running a 50, watching a 50K bike ride, to be real honest with you. So tell us about the distances and
So the at sort of the pro level of the sport, the under 20 meet used to be a 5 and they moved it up to a 10. And that was both domestic and international. The at the over 20 level, your pros, that was a 20 and a 50, and then the Olympics decided that they didn't want the 50 anymore for reasons. And World Athletics got sued for gender equality by a US athlete, and she won the lawsuit. And so they added the 50K for women, and that was right around the time where the IOC just went, oh, well, gender equality, we can't have that. And so they put enough pressure on Seb Coe to get rid of the 50. And so the 50 went away and got replaced by the 35, which is essentially just a longer version of the 20 because of physiology, and you don't really hit the wall until you get to 40, 37 to 40K. So it's really just a longer 20, and the same athletes end up winning. And then that went so well that they decided, well, we can't have that anymore. It actually, I mean, they were exciting races, great races. And you're getting men and women who are able to double and just races that are to the last lap and not a lot of disqualifications, which, I mean, it was really dynamic television. And that was nice to see because the 50K was always really dynamic too. Guys coming back in the last 2K of a race and then just passing six guys and getting a medal or then they started this relay thing, which we don't know how this is going to work out.
I was going to ask you about that. Yeah.
I get part of why they're doing it. I don't know how well it's going to work out because it's the first time they're doing this internationally. I mean, domestically, we had a really good event in Chula Vista. Actually, more like, I'm sorry, not Chula Vista, it was technically in Santee. Tracy Sunlin put that on.
I just saw him this weekend.
And he's everywhere. He is Mr. Everybody, one of the greatest guys.
Absolutely.
So we'll see how it works internationally, but it's an odd event because it's teams of two and they each have to do essentially 10K, then take 45 minutes off, and then go do another one. So how do you train for that? I had about seven athletes out there, and some of them handled it well, and some of them didn't. And but it was like we'll just roll in the dice here and see what happens.
So explain that. You explained it as if they both do a 10K and then have like a 45-minute halftime and then do another 10K. Not,
No, it's a relay.
yeah, okay, that's what I was.
So
Okay, so they do.
there's an exchange zone like the
Yeah,
four by
got it,
four,
got it,
and they
got it.
slap
Okay.
hands,
Yeah, I
and
heard
then
about
they
the slap
go.
hands. Yeah. That did
Yeah.
not help the race walking thing, by the way. I don't know how somebody put
No.
a baton in their hand. I don't know, but the slapping hands thing does not help with the whole the respect thing. Is the relay replacing?
The 35,
So
which
there'll be a
replaced the 50,
got
but then
it.
there's going to be a 35 in the World Championships again, and I don't know whether the relay is going to be there. This is an Olympics thing, so I don't know.
Okay. So in the Olympics, there'll be a 20K for men and
And a
women
relay.
individual.
Yeah.
And then there'll be a relay. Is the relay a co-ed or single
Yes.
sex? And that's a
It's it, and
co-ed.
each And each one does two legs. So the men lead off with a 12K, 12.195, so that the distance is a marathon.
Okay, I
And
was going to
then
ask why in the world. Okay, got it. Okay, that makes
why didn't
sense.
they just make it a 40? I don't know.
Yeah, but when you say the marathon, that makes sense. Okay,
Yeah.
so the guys start first, they do a 12.1 or whatever, then the women are second leg.
And then the men and then the women. So they always finish. It's kind of like the mixed 4x4.
In 12.1 for each leg.
No, it's then it's 10, 10, 10. So it becomes 42.195.
Oh, so the first leg is the long leg, 12.1, and then alternating 10Ks for the next three legs, and that gets you your whatever 26 miles
Your
and
marathon,
kilometers.
yeah.
Yeah, got it. Okay. So there'll be individual 20s and then a relay as well for race walking for the Olympics. World champs, they're still trying to figure out what in the world they're going to do, a 35 or et cetera. Okay. All
Yeah.
right. Okay. So why do they have to be these 20K, 35K, 50K? Why can't it be a mile, 4x8? I'm just, I'm just thinking here.
It goes back to the history of the sport
Okay.
and
Yeah, where is where
the
can you give us a 10-second version of that? Where does race walking start? We think of track in war times, right? So we threw a hammer during war, we threw a javelin during war, we had to hurdle things to get rid of people trying to kill us. Where did race walking kind of start?
how did you get to war? You marched.
But
You
politicians.
marched.
Oh, sorry.
No, you
Yeah.
marched.
Oh, okay.
And it kind of comes from that sort of mentality of these long marches.
Got it.
And race walking predates modern track and field because they had the pedestrianism in the 1800s.
Really?
And it was a professional sport. There were hundreds and thousands of dollars bet on these guys walking for 6 days in Madison Square Garden in with all the smoke and the cigarettes and everything. And these guys would walk for 6 days, and whoever was still breathing at the end, I guess, won the race.
Wow. Okay, that's cool history. I knew that's again, it's so interesting. If you're not in race walking, and even worse, if you're on the anti-race walking side, which I was, you don't know this is really interesting, like things like where it started in the marching, why they're doing a relay, why they're doing this, things like that. That's really, it's really interesting. I'm glad I did this, Michael.
So to
Yeah.
answer your question though, how it got to where it was,
Yeah,
the
yeah.
original Olympic races were 1500, 3K,
Yeah.
and the concern over the ability of judges way back in the day who didn't understand biomechanics and all the other stuff involved with training and observing how the body moves, making judging decisions. And so they determined that the athletes were moving too fast to be judged at those distances, so they wanted to slow them down. And the
Okay.
only way to do that was to make them go longer. And
Right.
so it went 1500 to 3K to 5K to 10K, 20K, 50K,
Right.
and there are guys who do 100K and they're out of their mind.
Yeah.
And I agree with you that I think the sport would be better served to have all these distances because not everyone is a 30K, 5K or a 20K guy. I mean, I'm best suited for somewhere between 10 and 20K when I'm training, but getting into a 50K, I could never get through it. And it may have been my best opportunity, but I couldn't do the training to get there. And you get guys who come from, they have more sprint mechanics and sprint physiology. Why can't they go walk a 3K at the international level? And they used to have that at World Indoors, but the concerns over judging, from people who are on the outside looking in and getting hysterical over, ooh, look at that. That's this, that's that.
So
And it got pulled.
is there no World Indoors walk?
They got rid of the World Indoors. I believe it was 96-ish,
Okay.
somewhere right around there.
Okay.
But they used to have heats of the thing.
Yeah.
You'd have to go
Wow.
do a 5K and then come back the next day and do another one.
Wow.
And these guys were walking, 1830.
Yeah. Can you really? You mentioned, someone coming back in the last 2K. Can you really kick in race walking? Or, and this to me doesn't take it away. This isn't a negative in my opinion, the way I'm going to explain it here. Can you really kick? Meaning, I get faster over the last 100 or 400 of this race to overtake the person in front of me, or is it more about who can decelerate the least? Kind of like in 100, you know, the 100, you are decelerating, and who decelerates the least wins. So is it actually I can get faster in the last 100 to overcome someone, or is it I fatigued less than that guy, so I'm able, you know, he's falling back faster as I'm catching up? That makes sense?
It's a bit of both.
Okay, okay.
And it depends on the athlete. You know, just like you've got your Steve Prefontaines who wanted to bury you, and then you've got your why am I drawing a blank on the Kenyan who became an American, this 5K guy?
Meb.
He was a 1500 5K guy, but you just never wanted to have a slow pace because he was going to kill you in the race. And he's a coach at Arizona now. And why I can't remember his name, I don't remember. But they would always just sit and let him kick. And it was like, what are you doing? You're just letting him win. Kip, we're going to be upset that we can't remember his name when we're done with this.
I can see his face. That's why I wouldn't say anything. It's like, I can see his face.
Shaved head. He would always racing Rupp and great would just sit on Rupp and get him. But
someone's yelling at us right now.
They're like, why can't you remember? He's the greatest American ever. Why can't you remember his name? Because I can never remember anyone's name. That's why. But the kicking and race walking outside of short races where the, you know, your youth and your high school kids are going, because, you know, a 1500 for some of those athletes is a long race. Because they don't have the physical maturity to hold the technique at speed. But when you get to the pro level, there's some kicking, but it's more like, you think of it more like a surge. So they're going to, instead of doing it in the last 100, they really need to do it over like an 800 where it's a constant change of gear. And they ramp up to the point where, okay, this is as hard as I can maintain a pace at legal technique before they just fall apart. And then it's not cheating. Not cheating. People are like, oh, the walker's cheating. You know, old man yelling at the television. It's their technique broke down because they're trying to do something they can't do. And so their competitive spirit and the adrenaline's going, go faster, go faster, go faster. And so their technique just falls apart. And, you know, you've seen that in the hurdles. Where a guy just, he runs up on the hurdles or he can't get his legs to where they need to and he crashes them. And the technique events do this all the time. The throws where somebody's just fatigued and they're in round six and it's in the cage.
Makes sense. Makes sense. Where do you think race walking should be? And let me preface that as you're thinking about how you already have the answer because it's what you do your whole life.
So it's my obsession.
The obsession. The marathon is not part of track and field, in my opinion. What I mean by that is they don't finish on the track. They don't run it all on the track. They start outside. Sometimes they'll finish, you know, in certain marathon is very much a road racing event. And that's fine. You know, that's not a derogatory. I'm just saying it's not part of track and field. Should race walking be a part of track and field, meaning it's all on the track, or should it be like a road racing? Again, that does not mean it's taking it down, in my opinion. Should it be its own sport, its own culture?
I think there could be a sort of a happy medium of both. Think about your 5K, 10K. How many 5Ks and 10Ks are on the track and on the road?
Yeah, I would tick off every distance runner by saying that also 3,000 steeple should be the highest we do on the track, in my opinion. Every distance runner, you're going to yell at me. I know. But
it's... No. I was going to say I've spent many, many, many years umpiring track meets. And oh my God, if they're doing another 5K, like I'll be at a meet and they'll have seven of them in a row. And I'm like, oh my God. This is too much.
But by the way, 100 heats of the 200 is also too much. Just put that out there. Not like I want to watch 100 heats of the 200 either. I would watch 100 heats of the hurdles. I'm not going to lie. I personally, but
they should be running them in both directions soon. They're doing that.
I was just at the Nike High School National Championships and they did the shuttle hurdle. And I tweeted that because that to me is the most phenomenal event in the world is the shuttle hurdle. That's why I would. Yeah. I love it. I would watch that a million times. Yeah, yeah. Sorry.
Have you seen when the armories run the steeplechase indoors?
No, but I saw their steeples there, and I was like, oh my god, I wish they were doing that because I've heard about it. Yeah, yeah,
it's really, really cool. They do it over like a 2K or something like that. Mm-hmm. But there's a place for it in and out, and because most of the pro level of race walking is road based, athletes need to get used to that world if that's where they're going to go. Okay. But having race walking have an existence and a vibrant existence on the track at the same distances without the steeplechase, because that'd be a little messy. I'm not yeah. really sure how you judge that.
Right, right.
But we joke about it often. We should do the 3K race walk steeplechase, but you know, you give us 10 meters on each side of the barrier.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Right.
So we can hurdle. And I would have done well in that because I ran the 400 hurdles in school. So yeah. I know how to hurdle. But yes, it can have a place. The same way you have your 15s, your 3s, your 5s, your 10s. Mm-hmm. And in the areas of the sport where it does exist, I don't understand why it's not in the same number of meets that you would have for your runners. Hmm. And that's even with the programs that are supporting it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you're taking your 1500 meter runner or your 5K runner to a meet every weekend, why is your race walker staying home? Hmm. They should have the same number of competitive opportunities. Mm-hmm. Soapbox coming down off. But it's a slow progression, and I'm, you know, constantly talking to coaches and trying to get them to recognize that the benefit it is to their own athletes, because the more times you race, the better you're going to be at racing.
Yeah.
And when you get to nationals, if you only race three times and then you're at nationals and the nerves get you,
right,
bad things happen.
Right. Right. Let's talk about this is a terrible transition, Mike. Let's talk about you.
And oh no.
What I mean by that is, and this is where I was really projecting when I said we're not going to have an argument here. You know, again, your passion, man, it's, I mean, I think I'm
unhinged.
I think I'm passionate about track and field coaches. And then I see you and I'm like, man, I got some ways to go to show my passion. I love that you just said that, unhinged. There are times, Michael, and this is where either this interview just derails and never sees the light of day, or because Mike and I are, both of us are adults, we can have this conversation. Your social media presence, there are times when, in my opinion, you stay at attack mode. Mm-hmm. You're certainly an advocate. I see a lot of posts and replies where, awesome that they had the race walk here. Great job from this person and things like that. And then there are conversations that aren't about race walking at all that you come out of left field and, hey, how come race walking wasn't there? Imagine if they did this with the race walk here. And I'm just like, man, there are times, Mike, I believe I am one of the most empathetic people when it comes to social media, meaning I know we don't always show our true colors there. Like sometimes we got our thumbs, we can say some things. Mm-hmm. And so there are times where I'm like, man, Mike, why would you step in here? Why you've replied off of some of my stuff that I'm just like, why? Mike's had nothing to do with you, Mike. But I also know, man, Mike is a caged tiger for race walk. So I also get that, you know. Do you ever, you said the word unhinged. Do you ever, I'm going to say the word regret. Do you ever have some regret sometimes?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I have shot myself in the face.
Okay.
Quite a number of times.
Okay. Yeah. That's tough. Yeah. You commented. We had Cliff Rivelto on the show, head coach at Kansas State. If you haven't listened to that, you got to go back and listen to it. He was great. And we talked at the end. I wanted to make sure I had a conversation with him about two things, changing track and field that I knew he was involved in and maybe had some passion for. One was raising the women's hurdles from 33 to 36. And the other was moving the women's heptathlon to the women's decathlon.
And you, those are both two good things. I will agree with you.
100%. You posted, you commented on the YouTube video, mm-hmm. Hey, Cliff, can we also get your support for the race walk? And I was like, Mike, what were you? I was just like, what are you doing?
Throw it out there and see what happens. Because you know when you, I mean, And that was not an attempt to sideswipe anyone, because I don't know Cliff personally, but I've listened to Cliff talk in other venues, and I know that he's an advocate for sort of the underdog in many regards. And if you don't throw the topic out, no one's going to talk about it. And sort of it's kind of like all PR is good PR, even though sometimes you'll throw some out there and it blows up and it doesn't work out the way you wanted it to do, but at least somebody was talking about it. So there are times, and that was in that case, that was what I was looking to do. It's like, oh, let's just see, does Cliff have even have an opinion on it?
I get it.
He's entitled to whatever opinion he has. He's earned that, and so does pretty much everybody else. But why don't we have that? What would be the reason? Because I've asked coaches privately, coaches who were at institutions like the University of Houston, like, why don't we have a race walk? What's the rationale behind it, other than I just don't want to deal with it? And that ends up being the majority of the cases. They just don't want to deal with it.
And now that I get, because I think about on the high school level, we're adding and trying to add in a lot of states the javelin. And a lot of
Yes, please.
the pushback always comes back to what I call a fake pushback, and that's safety. And I'm always like, you do the discus. If you can do the discus, you can already do the javelin in regards to safety.
And you play football where people hit each other in the head.
Correct. Yeah, absolutely. And two, the other thing comes back is, and it's more privately because no one wants to kind of say this, the quiet part out loud of, I don't want to deal with that. I don't want to learn how to coach. And it's like, that's a terrible excuse. I'm from the state of Alabama, and we figured it out for crying out loud. So you can't tell me that Texas, all these other states can't figure out how to eventually coach it. You can learn clinics, et cetera, and become a good javelin coach. So I do agree with you in the regards to the race walking side of like, hey, you don't want to deal with it. That's why you're not giving kids an opportunity. That doesn't seem like a very valid pushback.
And then when the same coaches are out there going, well, this is an opportunity for everyone. We're an inclusive sport, diversity, equity, inclusion, whatever buzzwords you want to throw out there. And then 5 minutes later, they're going, oh, no, can't talk about
Except
that.
for the race walk.
I do have to ask you a question, Alabama or Auburn?
Neither. I went to the greatest university in the world. I went to Troy University. My son's name is Troy, so it is Troy first, and then somewhere not too far down. I did grow up very close to Auburn. I had a lot of friends that played there. So yes, Auburn over Alabama. I'm sorry, Dan. I know Dan Waters
My
watches.
girlfriend was would have made me ask if she was in the room, because she's an
Yeah.
Alabama grad.
Oh gosh, I'm so sorry. Not so sorry. That don't mean that negatively, because again, I'm a Troy guy first and foremost. All institutions are great. Only one of my sons was named after an institution, and that was Troy. So yeah.
Tea is on top. Is that why?
Troy, baby. It's always that's where I found my faith, my love of life, track, everything. Everything came from my years at Troy University. Awkward pause. What were we talking
Yes, I
about?
know. I was like,
Yeah, I was like,
about
so
the equity and inclusion in the sport and everything.
Except for race walk, right?
Yeah.
So you had said you put it a lot harsher than I would have said. I'm going to say it my much more not harsh. You said you had shot yourself in the foot sometimes. Do you have an example that you're willing to share? That's a tough question.
Off the top of my head, no, but I'm sure
Yeah.
there are a thousand. If I scroll through my Twitter, I'm
Sure.
sure I could
Just
find
someone's called you the race walking
them.
jerk, I imagine.
Oh, I'm sure they use other four-letter words.
Sure. But I imagine no one has not participated in the event because of that. If anybody was going to participate in race walking, I don't think they're like, you know what, this guy's too much of a bulldog. I'm going to just stay over here to the 5K or something like that. So I
Yeah,
think,
no.
I like your point about, especially for an event that is, I don't know if this is the right word. This may be too harsh. You smack me
It's
back here.
okay. I've heard it.
That's bastardized. It's the weird cousin in the corner, and I'm not sure it should be. I still am not on board with the 50K thing. I just can't wrap my head over any race like that for track and
It's
field.
the
But
50K is not an event for everyone.
yeah.
And I, as much as I was passionate about supporting it, I understand where they're coming from when they're trying to have a mass market sport that appeals to larger audiences. And as compelling as those races were over the, especially over the last decade, I get why they went away from the 50K. And to offer the opportunity at these shorter distances where things are quicker and they're done in an hour, it on the business end, it makes sense. I get it.
If I had to race walk an 800 meter, it still wouldn't be done under an hour. So I get that. Where, so wrap us up here, Mike. Where is race walking going? What's in the works? What, you talked about some of the changes we're making on the Olympic level, still hasn't moved maybe to the world champs level from what I'm hearing. What's, are there any states that are entertaining this? Is there a movement within NCAA or junior college? Is it going to stay club? What are we looking, what should we be looking for here in the next 5, 10 years in the race walk events?
So the focus primarily of the grassroots slash youth and collegiate development areas is to build numbers, to get, a bigger bottom of the pyramid. And my primary focus, and with the others that I work with around the country, both club and high school and mostly NAIA, but a smattering of NCAA schools too, is just getting the athletes connected to the coaches and getting more athletes staying around longer. If you look at the youth end, there's a drop off from the lower age groups, the 12 and under, and then once they get to 13 and older, the participation numbers kind of drop by about a third to a half because they are these a lot of these athletes now have high school teams where they don't have the opportunity, and so they're not with their club anymore, or if they are, they stop race walking because they're doing more running. So trying to grow that, and spending every waking hour doing social, trying to get these kids the attention that they deserve. Taking that and trying to push that lower end growth in the youth end and then to the high schools, where I got a message the other day and that they're looking at something in Connecticut, and I don't know what's going to become of it, but we'll see. The NAIA is sort of the one bucket where there's been some level of success both in the high performance and in the growth of just the average athletes and participation. And over the last 4 years, the participation level at the NAIA has doubled.
Oh, I was going to ask, is it
Number,
strong? Like, there's no talks of
it's
removing it from
getting
NAIA.
there.
Okay.
Well, at the coaches meeting every year, there's some harebrained scenario proposal that comes from a handful of coaches, which is just the same massaged language, twisted and turned, sort of like a congressional bill that they try to get passed to remove race walking, and they'll hide it or they'll be open about it. But it's once you look at it and you go, oh, I see what they're doing here. They're going to use this to get rid of race walking. There was the one this past year, and the coaches shut it down yet again. Because why are you telling another coach what he can and can't coach? I mean, you don't have to coach it. That's fine. But don't tell another coach or another athlete what they can and can't do. The opportunity should be there. If you choose to give those points away, thank you. I know coaches who will take them. But so over the last 5 or 6 years or so, in even with COVID shot in the middle of that, the participation numbers on the NAIA have doubled, and it should only get better. And this year, for the first time, they had heats in the national championships, just like they do for the 3000 run. They had heats of the 3K, and the talk is that they may go heats in a final in the future. And because if they can run it, why can't they walk it? And so growing that and trying to build, I've been trying to spend more of my time, energy, money, whatever, building that lower base, because if you don't have that grassroots bottom of the pyramid, you can't ever have the elites because you're just going to self-select out.
That's right. That's exactly right. That makes a lot of sense. Michael, this was more fun than I thought. I knew I was going to learn some stuff, and I learned a ton. Like, actually, you really kind of lifted a veil off my eyes in regards to the competition side of it, of the, you know, the three fouls, and you know, the event rules are the human nature of the judge, not any one still photo and video and things like that. So that was really phenomenal. Where do we go to learn more? Someone out there is listening and is like, hey, you know what? Either I have it at my club, but I really don't know a lot about it, but you know, I'm not going to give up those points, but I'd like to learn more. Or someone's listening right now, and they're like, hey, you know what? Maybe I should at least look into it. Maybe there's an opportunity for kids in my area. Is the right place to go is the hsrw.net? Is that the first place to kind of go?
That's sort of like the clearinghouse of everything that both I've put together and linked to other resources. And so there's a bunch of statistical information on there. There are links to other websites where you can learn things. And taking a cue from everything that you've been doing, and I know we talked about this earlier, but I too have a YouTube channel.
Yeah, I've been to ask that. I'm glad you said that. Yep.
The High School Race Walk YouTube channel, which is linked on the website, but if you just search for HS Race Walk on YouTube, you'll find it. There's just short of 1,000 videos on there of all different areas involved with race walking, with training, with coaching. There, every race video that I can find is on a playlist somewhere. And then there's the content that I produce, which is some interviews, some coaching stuff. Not as much on the coaching stuff as I wanted to do, but also a lot of highlights and PR for the athletes who don't get the same exposure. Mm-hmm. But that would be where you'd want to go to find that. And if you're looking at this from the coaching aspect, there's a coaching education playlist that has links to the awesome content that coaches have put together from around the US and around the world. And you can find it all in one spot without having to go to all of their channels. Right. You can go there and then just play the playlist. And there's I think there's about 100 or so videos just on coaching ed.
Wow. Dude, thank you. I really am blown away. This was a lot of fun. I have even more respect for the event. Like I said, I dropped my childish anti race walking a while ago now. But I definitely, I'm more of a fan. I'm less of a skeptic. I told you when I started, I'm kind of a skeptic. Mm-hmm. I am less of a skeptic because of your background. Again, I love when things take people from one place and make higher for them. And so, you know, for you, Michael, if you didn't find race walking, you might be some accountant in New York somewhere, or a history, a library historian or something, you know.
Oh, that would actually be cool.
And that's awesome. I'm a huge library fan. I'm on the board of our local library. Mm-hmm. Actually, I'm a huge librarian, so no knock on librarians, but it wouldn't have helped me in my sport. Right. So I love that you found a calling, a real calling. I mean, like, this is, you know, you're the type of person, I cut you bleed out race walkers. You know, you bleed out yellow paddles. That would have been a much better joke.
Yeah, I was going to say, yellow
much
paddles.
Better, much better, much better. And so I love that. That is really what interests me in the human race is passions. And so, you know, it's evident and I love it. I love that, you know, hell or high water, you're going to megaphone for race walkers. And I have a lot of respect for that because, you know, I'm similar esque on that side for track and field coaches in general. So I really love that, Mike. And I'm so thankful for you, man. You're thankful for your time. It's one of the, you know, you missed out on like 20 tweets to go get someone during this time here. So I'm just so thankful for your time and your passion and really grateful for you.
Thank you very much. And I appreciate the opportunity.
Absolutely. All right. Go check out hsrw.net. And then also on YouTube, if you just search HS Racewalk, that'll get us there.
Yeah. If you go to youtube.com/HS Racewalk.
Oh, HS Racewalk. Perfect. Go there, check it out. And I would challenge you, if you have any inkling of like, this should be in your club, or maybe, you know what, I love that the NAIA has doubled participation, but something tells me that there are still a lot of NAIA schools that are not participating. It's kind of like the schools that don't do pole vaulting. And I love how Michael put that. You're giving up those points. Thank you. I'll take those. Stop giving up those points. I bet you there are coaches out there right now that aren't doing the race walk for their program that could and should be doing it, and you do it at a pretty high level because you're a really smart coach. So I'd encourage you, reach out to Michael on social media. I'm going to go out on a limb. If I Google his name, his email or something will pop up as well. But reach out to him. And, you know, if he can't be the one to help you because of geography, et cetera, he's got a network. So I just encourage you to reach out.
I was going to say, I've got a list of all the recruits for 24 and 25.
Oh,
if you're
gosh.
Looking to recruit.
Yeah, come on. Let's get this started.
Their Instagrams.
Let's double the double in NAIA, because I agree with you, Mike. You know, the base has to get bigger if you're going to have a higher point. And, you know, I've seen in Team USA where we don't do historically, we don't do great. We've had great people like Seaman and many others. But we need to, just like we want to dominate all of our track events. Well, this is part of track and field, so let's dominate the race walk as well. So, Michael, thank you so much for being here. Thank you guys and gals for being here and listening. Just so humbled that you guys be here every week, man. So let's join us next week. We'll do it all over again. Thanks, everybody. Have a good one.
The ghosts who appreciate the coach, the ones who point people most. Every season needs a voice of reason, speaking the growth. You gotta prep before you carry the load. It's coffee to the soul for those of us who stay on the go. Proper handoff to stay in the zone. What you packing for the road? There's more than one way to go. Take notes, that's paying your toll. It ain't practice if your purpose ain't clear. It can't happen till you listen with both ears. You can't mentor without a mentor's years of experience, so you can reinvent those years. Every plan's got a standard to live up to. And the price sacrifice, can you give up you? It's a choice and a fight, not a win or lose. It's not a ploy, but advice so y'all can make more moves. It's not about how to, it's all about why. You don't know till you know who you are inside. 6 million ways to tie, choose none. So we all cross the finish line, the work ain't done. So we learn from the experts, we all gotta put in the legwork. Gil Athletics is a network, it's all about connections. Put together for the profession, so every track coach can be blessed.